Welcome back to Killer Fan, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you're back with us today. Today, we are talking about You, Season 3, Episode 1, Oh No, and They Lived Happily Ever After. Oh, sorry. My coffee. We have puppies. And they spilled a little of my coffee, and so some of the things I was supposed to read are a little smeared.
It's chaos in here.
It's a little chaos in here.
I think we now need to start saying, I'm Chrissy, I'm Jackie, and then there's Ripley and Daisy.
That's right. Podcast puppies.
Yes. Oh, uh-huh. I love that. Podcast puppies.
They are
little podcast puppies.
Okay, but before we start talking about You.
Okay.
So we talked about how we think that professional critics review shows differently than, say, the lay people who are just somebody who likes or dislikes a show and goes on Rotten Tomatoes and...
And reviews it.
And reviews it.
Yes, I remember this because, okay, let me see if I remember correctly. Critics watch a couple episodes, kind of like we do.
Right.
Because we're critics. Uh-huh. Yes. Professional critics. And viewers actually just review it after the end.
Right, usually, yes.
Usually.
I would say that's...
Typical?
Yes, especially for shorter or newer shows. They do that kind of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, we did. We talked about this.
Yes. So The Stranger was a limited series, and critics who only watched a few episodes really liked it.
That was me at the time we did the podcast.
Yes. And viewers who reviewed it, many of them were a little less enthusiastic because they'd watched the whole show.
Kind of like you.
Yes, like me, who had watched all of it because I get started on something and I'm like a dog with a bone. I'm a podcast puppy. And I just can't let it go until it's done. So I had seen all of it and was curious as to what you thought of the ending.
Yeah. So I did. I finished it.
Uh-huh.
And you're not wrong.
Yeah.
I do get it now because I didn't realize how high my expectations were because of the unfolding of the story and the uniqueness of being able to see how people's lives were unfolding in such a way that would cause them to intersect.
Right.
Rather than following one point of view and then kind of bringing in the cast of characters as needed.
Right.
And I really liked it. And actually, I still stand behind that fully. Uh-huh. I still enjoyed that completely. But the ending was a little,
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And that's why I think that the audience score is a little lower.
Yeah.
Because they came to the end. And I feel like I just am a little more forgiving about some of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, as long as the ride was really good, I'm okay with the ending being kind of meh.
Meh.
But.
Yeah. It was just anticlimactic.
Right.
But also a nice tidy bow.
Yeah.
For being such a.
Maybe a little too.
Kind of sad.
A little too easy and a little too quick. And, but still really awful and hard.
Yeah, not quick enough.
Okay, yeah.
So for the ending, there's a one part where a big mystery is finally solved and revealed, and I want it to, cut to black right there. What? You know, there was a nice tidy bow after that, but the nice tidy bow didn't resolve any other tensions.
Right.
Or create other tensions.
Right.
And so, in some ways, it did, let me go kindly. Like, I was able to go, okay, and walk away.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think we're not used to
that. It's like there was too much resolution and also not enough.
Yes, all of that. Yeah, this ending, I don't know if it says something about the show or about, me, that it was too resolved and not enough. And I'm like, it feels like that was actually a very healthy ending to the whole story. And I'm not satisfied with it. So what does that mean?
Oh.
Nothing?
No.
Cheers. Okay, good. Okay. Move on.
Yeah. All right. So You, Season 3, Episode 1, charming, but with a penchant for violence. Joe and his new little family are trying to fit in the wealthy suburbs of San Francisco. They both want to change, but where would the entertaining TV show be if they were successful.
I mean, right.
I mean, for real. They for need real. Some tension. They need some disagreement. And just a reminder from us and from Netflix, Penn Bagley is hot.
Oh, yes.
Joe Goldberg is not.
I know. But.
No buts. Full stop. Joe is not hot. He can be physically attractive, but he is not hot because he's a homicidal maniac.
He is a homicidal maniac, but he's also trying to change. And I appreciate that. I know. I could rationalize this all day long. It's true, though. They are not good people.
Oh, no.
But it is interesting to watch this inner monologue unfold. The inner monologue is just... It's interesting because mm-hmm. he is constantly trying to find ways to get out. And he was actually fairly successful until.
Uh-huh. Until.
Yeah. And then you're like, well, gosh, that is a process, isn't it? You know, changing is a process. And it's like, I don't know whether I'm rooting for him or whether he just can't change and this is just manipulation. Like, I don't know what they're doing to me. But it sure is entertaining. It and you're sure right, Penn Bagley is hot.
Yeah. He's
so hot. I want to apologize up front for the complete objectification of this person throughout this podcast because I am going to struggle with that. Forgive me. Uh-huh. We know you're a real person, yeah. Penn. We appreciate that and forgive us our objectification.
And, oh, Penn, you're totally Jackie's type.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I never really think of you as having a type. But you totally have a type.
I do totally have a type.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's it.
Yeah. Which is funny because he doesn't look dissimilar to your husband.
No, I think type continues right there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah, your type, you married your type.
I kind of did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least physically.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I had a really good friend in college who became a boyfriend at some point. And then, you know, we broke up. And then later on, you know, when I was dating my husband and he met this person that I was dating who uh-huh. became my husband. And my friend looks at me and starts laughing and said, like looking in a mirror. And I was like, shut up. He was not wrong though. He was not wrong. Yeah. And you know, I have to say, depends credit. Also, he's a musician, which makes me very happy. Mm-hmm. But I love his band Mother and I wish they would come out with more music.
Oh, I'm going to have to check it out.
It's very alternative. It's very rock. It's very
I like that.
It's super good. And Penn's got a great voice. And I mean, the whole album is just great. I enjoy it.
Oh, cool.
It's good stuff.
I'm going to have to check it out.
Yeah.
We're going to have to post some stuff. I'm a 90s girl. I like the alternative stuff.
Yeah. And it's very synth grungy. It's a very mm-hmm. interesting, it doesn't fit well inside a category, which can be sometimes a breakout or kind uh-huh. of that is exactly what keeps you from getting seen.
Right.
But I like it. Good.
Oh, I'll have to check it out. All right, let's talk about this cast real
yes.
quick. Now, we talked about Penn Bagley's Joe, Victoria Pedretti's Love. Saffron Burroughs plays Love's mother, Dottie, Glamma.
Glamma.
She was, yeah, I just, we'll get there. She was in the prime original Mozart in the Jungle. Dylan Arnold plays Theo, and he's in the rebooted Halloween series of movies mm-hmm. that just had an installment come out. Jack Fisher plays Young Joe. He has a reoccurring role as Phineas in NCIS.
Yes, I recognize Jackie's him right smiling. Off. I was like, oh, look, it's Phineas.
Tati Gabrielle plays Marianne. She's in the CW's The 100. And my youngest would recognize her voice from Disney Plus's The Owl House.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I would not.
Me either, but my kid likes it.
Okay.
So, yeah. Shalita Grant plays Sherry. She was in Search Party, NCIS New Orleans. Michaela McManus plays Natalie. She was on One Tree Hill, Law & Order SVU. I recognized her from The Vampire Diaries.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And Travis Van Winkle is Carrie. And he was in 5 seasons of TNT's The Last Ship.
Yeah, I've not seen that.
Me either. I guess it's a sort of unusual kind of show.
Okay.
All right. Recap.
Recap.
You ready for it?
Oh.
It's short and sweet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
All right. So Joe is married to his murder partner and mother of his child, Love. Do you like that murder partner?
Because you said it so sweetly. Like you could have said life partner.
No,
or murder partner.
Yeah, there you go.
The family that murders together.
May or may not stay together. But just because he's married to Love doesn't mean he's given up on looking for the one.
Hmm.
She's maybe not it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Joe feels trapped by this woman he doesn't love, a baby he thought was going to be a girl, and a town that he describes as white picket purgatory.
He is not wrong.
I mean, for real.
They have some beautiful houses.
I mean, the houses are gorgeous. There's a lot of amenities, good schools and things, but I don't know that there's enough money to have me live in that kind of societal environment.
Yeah, it's a little much.
It's more than a little much. But all that is worth it if it leads him to his one true love. But who is it? Maybe his neighbor Natalie?
Maybe.
Maybe. Joe's stalking of Natalie is a break from a colicky baby and his constant hypocritical grousing about Love's homicidal tendencies. Our anti-hero's used to being the only maniac on the block, but between Love, Natalie, Glamma Dottie, the momfluencer blogger, her health-obsessed bisexual husband, fussy library employees, they all give him a run for his money.
Yeah, he is not the only maniac on the block.
Not by a long stretch. And Love is right about one thing. Marriage counseling is the very least that this couple needs.
Yeah.
So, Vulture liked it. They liked it so much. Catherine Van Arendonk says, "You is the best it's ever been." I was like,
ooh.
I could agree with that.
Yeah, you agree with that?
I
just love it all so much. I don't know that I can choose.
I love it all so much, but I really like this season.
Yeah.
It's good. I like it. Unreliable narrators are a challenge for screen storytelling, and few shows can pull it off, much less do it with use warp, twisted confidence. Most important change for season 3 is the thing that shifts the fundamental geometry of how the show works. In season 3, Joe is not alone. Love is just as dark and violent as Joe, as drawn to problem solving by using extreme, irreversible, bloody devices. So true. Suddenly, the one-way direction of the show's momentum is a much more complicated two-body problem. Love is a foil for Joe, a mirror, but also a nemesis, his love object, the mother of his child, and a constant reminder of his own flaws.
Nice. Well done.
I thought that was excellent. And IndieWire likes it, and they really like how they use the history of the show to really move the story forward. Steve Green says, "The show started out so aligned with Joe's perspective that any mistake or error in judgment almost felt like the show doing the same. Now, with 2 seasons worth of extra knowledge, it's clearer when Joe is kidding himself. With each new time that his inner monologue doesn't match up with his actions, it's easier to see a man terrified by losing whatever anchors he has left. His delusions of righteousness and virtuousness butt up against his own fatal narcissism."
Yes, I love it. That's a great description of why his narrative is so interesting.
Yes, because I love it when he's doing something, he goes, oops, like, oh, that happened and I didn't expect it to happen that way.
Right, and, like when it's predictable.
Uh-huh.
It's totally predictable. And it does, I think what it is, it's like a little insight into, sometimes, you know, when people are saying they're trying to change and you're like, really?
Uh-huh.
But this,
yeah,
is happening, and we don't trust it.
No,
it isn't reliable. But how long do you hold out hope that there's little increments of progress? What's progress and what's not? It's absolutely chaos, and I love it.
Uh huh. Yes. Well, and it's just so interesting because in the first, even through the second season, you really feel like Joe has a plan.
Mm, Yeah.
And that he's very methodically planned things out. And I really, what I really love about this season is that you can tell he's now working with equals or near intellectual equals, whereas in the past he was a little bit smarter than the people right. he was trying to deceive. And now you can see that even if he has things all planned out, things aren't going the way he expects them to.
Right. Like he didn't get to choose his targets. His targets are now those of availability rather uh-huh. than he targeting.
Right.
And so now he's just looking for targets that are in his orbit that he can reach. And all of a sudden they're not as low risk.
Right. Yes. He can't manipulate the situation the same way that he could in the past.
Right.
Yeah.
Ooh. Good stuff. Good yeah. stuff.
We'll be right back after this quick break with Is It True? Psychology Break and Real Life.
So here's how it works. Christy wrecks her search history. Hey, NSA, we promise it's nothing more nefarious than a podcast. To find out what's true, some of the psychological motivations behind the character's actions, and real-life applications that relate to our topic. I have no idea what Christy decided to look up. Could be the same thing that captured my curiosity or something I never thought of.
And we're back with Is It True? So can you visit Madre Linda?
I mean, it looks like...
Sort of?
No, but yes.
Sort of.
Okay.
So there isn't a Madre Linda in California.
Okay.
But it seems like the writers combined the characteristics of several California towns
okay.
in order to create it and borrowed some names from a couple of them.
Okay.
So, wealthy suburbs of Los Angeles include Yorba Linda, which is one of the most expensive places to live in the United States.
Oh, okay.
And Sierra Madre, which is one of the safest communities in California. Uh-huh.
I see uh-huh. that. Uh-huh.
And they're both very upper middle class, trying to have the Los Angeles life without actually living in the middle of the city.
Yeah. Do we call them middle class, really? Even for upper middle class, it's a little...
I think that but they also draw from Atherton, California, which is declared the richest zip code in all of America.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's very tech-fueled, very exclusive. So it's drawing from that as well.
Okay.
So while Yorba Linda and Sierra Madre might be sort of upper middle class, there it's also drawing from Atherton. So people are not upper middle class.
These are not upper middle class. This is not depicting upper middle class.
No, this is beyond that.
Yeah.
But the almost like they want the upper middle class lifestyle, but with more amenities and more exclusive.
Now that makes sense. Like, usually you're going the opposite way, but I think you're right. Like yeah. they're the ones who are actually trying to create something that feels more quote authentic or more
they're trying Americana. They're trying to be very every man,
mm-hmm.
but with every tech gadget, every
all conveniences,
every luxury.
Yeah, I can't say I don't understand because that sounds nice.
Yeah. So while you can't actually, get an Airbnb in
Madre Linda,
it was filmed on the Warner Brothers backlot.
Now, I almost said it kind of looks like the backlot because it's a little perfect.
it is. And it should look familiar because it was in Gilmore Girls, Pretty Little Liars,
okay.
Heart of Dixie, and WandaVision.
I wish I would have said what I was thinking. Because I thought that and I was like, it feels a little Gilmore Girls-ish. Not because it looks like it, but because it's this perfect depiction of a Connecticut town uh-huh. that Gilmore Girls has. Like this, if you took all of the little bits and put them together and
yes.
output this perfect Stars Hollow. And so that is actually the exact feeling I got.
Yeah. But because it's you should.
Well, they did a good job. Okay.
They did a really good job. And Love's Bakery
mm-hmm.
appears to be Luke's diner.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
I've seen stills looking from out the windows of Luke's Diner and out the window of Love's Bakery.
You get some of the same street orientation a little bit.
It's the same. Yeah. It's not just the same orientation. You realize the windows are the same view out the window is the same. And
Yeah.
And the library was Stars Hollow High.
Oh. Uh-huh.
So you can sort of go and see it.
Yay! So cool. Two birds, one stone. Uh-huh.
And then Bustle noticed that Madre Linda is maybe also a rough translation of Beautiful Mother that might give you some insight into season 3.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. But also Penn's band is named Mother.
Yes.
Now I'm drawing conclusions and correlations where they do not exist. It's fun. Join me.
We've spent so much time fighting against it, and then you ask them to join you to do it.
I know. Everybody has to have a weakness.
So Joe turns to his literary heroes to try and explain parenthood. And all of the authors that he mentions, all real authors.
Legit, yes. Right? Legit. So
Nicholson Baker, he thinks that an essay about parenthood would talk about the quiet, beautiful moments. And that would make sense because he is known with his fiction as generally de-emphasizing narrative in favor of careful description and characterization.
Mm-hmm.
So he's more about the who and what rather than the why.
Okay.
Yeah. Or Louisa May Alcott, difficult but worthwhile, author of Little Women and others. And she was an abolitionist and feminist. Mm-hmm. So difficult but worthwhile.
Yeah.
That was like what she did in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Yes. But what it turns out to really be like is the work of Jean-Paul Sartre, who is, you know, a philosopher and existentialist.
I actually really love that part because I was like, oh, nailed it.
I mean, for real. It's not this idyllic sort of life that is so often depicted, you know.
Yeah, where did that even come from?
Yeah.
Like, how did it even become an ideal when there was nothing on which to base this?
Okay, because you forget.
Do we?
Some of us do. I mean, I haven't forgotten, and that's why I stopped at 2 children. Because I have not forgotten what it's like to have a colicky baby.
Oh.
I think people tend to look back on it with rose-colored glasses. I love you, go away.
Yes.
I love you, go away. That's the whole thing that I feel about parenthood, and we just did that to the dogs.
So. We just did to the dogs exactly what we're talking about. Yes. It is hard. I do. It's not like we don't look back, but I do wonder where some of these images come from that feel so detached from reality, because it almost makes reality feel that much darker because we haven't appreciated it appropriately.
I have a theory.
Oh, please do.
I have a theory that it's men who write about that stuff. You see where I'm going with this. And very often, not all men, we know not all men, but enough men that it is worth recognizing, don't have a lot of the hands-on day-to-day difficultness that might make them remember it more accurately. More the way you and I would recall it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
There's a reason why I deemed it Evil Thursdays when my kids were little. Oh, have I not told you about Evil Thursdays?
No, what about Evil Thursdays? Okay,
when my kids were little, we had Evil Thursdays.
Okay.
Because you would get to the end of the week, you'd get to Thursday afternoon after school, and they were just so tired, and they had to get up and do it again. Okay, and they knew it. And it was just a level of exhaustion and upsetness. I would tell the kids, let's try and not have an evil Thursday.
Whoa.
Because even they recognized it, that they were crabbier on Thursday afternoons. They were more tired on Friday afternoon. But because they didn't have to get up and do it again the next day, it was easier to deal with somehow.
That's funny.
All of her worst days were on Evil Thursdays.
Wow.
The time that Clara decided that they weren't going to listen to me at all.
Was Thursday.
Was a Thursday. And it was very funny because I told the kid they were screaming at me nonstop. They'd already eaten dinner. And I was like, okay, let's take a bath and go to bed. I'm not going to do it. I'm like, that's fine. Then you can go to bed and you don't have to take a bath. I have to take a bath. I'll take a bath. And, so, oh, and I'm like, goodness. Oh, I'm sorry. That ship has sailed.
You knew her. You knew the currency.
Yes. Yes.
You knew their currency.
I did. Yeah. And I played it. And boy, that kid finally went to sleep at like 7:15 at night and slept straight through until 7:30 the next morning. They were just so tired.
Oh my gosh. Is that pattern still kind of visible today?
A little bit. But they really recognize that if they're crabby on a Thursday afternoon, they're like, oh, it's Evil Thursday. And they'll correct it themselves.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Well done. Yeah. Well done. Yeah.
You know, but I think that I have a theory. That's my theory.
That is a good theory.
That it's, you know, when you read about it, maybe Nicholson Baker would write about, you know, the quiet, lovely moments of parenthood. And because he wasn't around for some of the more uncomfortable moments.
Right. That totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. I like this theory.
Yeah. Or not around, just busy, not paying attention.
Right. Yeah. Not like they abandon. It's just a matter of like, it wasn't their primary job. And so their outlook on it is just a little distanced. Rosier.
Yeah.
A rosier.
Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So baby Henry was a crier, and evidently neither Love nor Joe, despite the fact that they're both big readers, ever picked up the What to Expect books to read anything about colic, because he was a very intense crier, and they attributed all the crying to their own internal demons. A lot of projection as to why baby Henry was crying.
Right.
You know, your heart's not in it, or I don't love him enough, or whatever, when really it was probably just colic. Yeah, which is, just so you know, defined as episodes of crying for more than 3 hours a day, more than 3 days a week, for 3 weeks at a time in an otherwise healthy child. And it affects up to 40% of babies.
Yes. It's not like an uncommon thing.
It's not uncommon. And they don't really know why it happens. And only 5% of children afflicted with colic have an actual underlying disorder.
Right.
It's just a thing that's a developmental thing that's happening in some babies, but not all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to deal with, but it's not. It's scary if you don't know what you're dealing with.
Right. So Joe followed Natalie to the grocery store, and he had a little fantasy.
Yes, he did.
Put himself in a little bit of a compromising position in the parking lot. Yeah, that's really indecent exposure, by the by.
If that were to actually have occurred in the parking lot of, like, the H-E-B.
Yeah, or the Piggly Wiggly.
Or the, you know, Publix, or the whatever. That would be indecent exposure. Uh-huh. Yes, yes. I think I was aware that that would not be okay.
Yes.
And so I'm not surprised by that at all.
No. Yeah. And even if his fantasy had been true and he'd been fooling around with Natalie in the parking lot, also that would have been indecent exposure.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's, you know, alone or with a partner where you can have a reasonable expectation that someone outside of your household might see you engaging in such behavior.
Not okay.
Right. Exactly. You can end up in jail for 30 days. You can have a fine, depending on where you live, of how much.
Yeah, so don't do that.
Maybe don't.
Just don't do that.
Or put a blanket over you.
At the very least.
Or just don't do that. If you have a home.
Do it home.
Yeah. I mean, we don't, no judgment.
No, yeah, like literally, no, but just not in our parking lot.
Right, yeah, just not where a child might see you or, you know, my mom. Don't subject my poor, sweet 80s Catholic mother to your wonderland. But Natalie interrupts him.
Which was the greatest scene.
So funny. And he pretended to be sleeping. There's no sleeping going on.
No.
But she did warn him that breastfeeding isn't a reliable form of birth control. And she's correct.
She is correct in this.
She is very that correct.
That's an old wives' tale.
Yes. WhatToExpect.com may be a place that Joe and Love could have visited and learned a few things.
Yeah, that and Baby Center. Exactly. Bookmark them.
Yeah. Says that it can suppress ovulation for a time, and how effective that is depends on a whole lot of factors. How much you're breastfeeding, it can determine on how much sleep you've gotten, how much you weigh, all different kinds of things can play into this. Just regular genetic hormonal things, you might be more predisposed or less predisposed to ovulate while you're nursing. Even if you haven't gotten your period, your ovulation precedes your period. Right. So you can get pregnant before you've even had your first period. I know a number of people who've had that happen.
Yep.
And yeah, it's not fun to...
No, that is an Irish twin situation, you want to avoid that. Because especially really right after you give birth, you don't have a pattern enough to predict your ovulation. And so you really don't know when it's coming.
Right.
And, yeah.
I mean, and theoretically, you could do the whole basal temperature tracking and all of that.
Yes, you could.
But your sleep schedule is so messed up. And for that to be accurate, you need to have a pretty regular sleep schedule.
Yeah. So, yeah, just not protection. Yeah. I mean, it's just not protection. Like,
do something.
Do something.
Do something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, momfluencers.
Thank you. I'm so glad you're going to talk about this.
Not only real, but a real company. Momfluence.co.
Momfluencers, mompreneurs, like this was a big deal.
As long as they're not in an MLM, I'm okay with it. Momfluence.co says, we help brands grow by connecting them to moms who have digital influence. Our platform is built to make influencer marketing easier and more profitable for brands, while also making it easier for influencers and content creators to get hired for amazing campaigns.
Yep.
Which I'm like, that's so cool. I don't want any part of that.
No, I kind of have the blogosphere. I have a love-hate relationship with it.
Sure.
You know, because on the one hand, I love some of these mompreneurs and these, like, mommy bloggers and the mom influencers, or what was it?
Momfluencers.
Uh-huh. You know, in some ways, I love, like, the collective insight and wisdom from people who have lived life and figured out something and share their story or share kind of what they learned. And, you know, I'm all for that.
Right.
But on the other hand, a lot of people in that world tend to label themselves experts.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm like, full stop.
Right. Well, because my preferred momfluencers are those who are like, look, I'm just muddling through just like you are.
Right. Like it's a person in the battlefield with you, maybe a few steps ahead.
Right.
And it's nice. It's community. But there's a lot of people who are then capitalizing on, you know, book deals and speaking and acting like they're parenting experts or psychology experts or, God forbid, personality experts, because they've become some sort of blogger that has gained followers, but they haven't done the work behind it.
Right.
I'm okay if you've done the work behind it, but most of them have not.
Right.
Be very careful, people.
Exactly.
Be very careful.
And what works for you, they tend to say, here's what worked for me.
Yes.
It will also work for you, ignoring the individualism of the children.
Right. Yeah. Without much resource around it either.
Right.
Right. So you just have to kind of be discerning when you pick your idols, you know?
Maybe don't have idols.
Maybe not idols.
Maybe just to pick a few that you enjoy reading because they're entertaining and down to earth and not because you need help. If you need help, you know, there's a lot of professionals with like actual degrees.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of accessible research out there.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, Baby Center and What to Expect. These are places that synthesize, you know, good consensus and deliver it, and then connect you to people that they have said, oh, these bloggers, these people with informal kind of communications are really good people to follow. And that, like, maybe go that way.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah.
Just be careful.
Yeah.
I don't feel like bad about about those that, like, I do MLMs. But I just feel like they just deserve a little bit more discernment in some ways.
Uh-huh. Agreed. So Natalie checked out some books from the library, which we saw because Joe is stalking her.
Yes.
I mean, full on stalking her while wearing his baby.
Yeah.
Which I thought found a little troubling.
Oh.
I'm not going to lie.
Troubling, but hysterical, because he had to mention that, like, he's wearing the most female attracting accessory ever. And all he's trying to do is stay incognito. It was hysterical.
Uh-huh. It was very funny. That's what's so great about the show is that he's like literally legitimately funny.
It really is funny.
I mean, so, but the books that she checked out are real and award-winning series.
Okay.
So the fifth season, The Obelisk Gate and The Stone Sky are the Broken Earth series from N.K. Nemison.
I feel like I would like these.
I think, yeah, maybe you would. And mm-hmm. I think the basic premise kind of fits. There's a reason why they chose this. And I really appreciate the whomever did the choosing of the books, whether that was props department or whether that was more a thought out sort of thing from the producers or the showrunners. But it's a society that's very, very structured in and monitored in its caste system. And it's not based primarily on merit, but almost entirely on innate ability. And the innate abilities are a number of things. But
yeah.
Yeah. So it's very much where and how you're born.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like very few of the people in Madre Linda are there because they've, I don't want to say because they've earned it, but they had a leg up to start with.
Yeah, there's a bit of a class system going on, yes, obviously.
For
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
And then Natalie also picked a book out for Joe in a very flirtatious sort of situation, which is annoying for a married woman to a married man, but yes, you know, it happens, whatever. But she chose Tender is the Night. It was the fourth and final novel by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Which I've never read.
Not me either, but he wrote it while his wife, Zelda Fitzgerald, was hospitalized for schizophrenia. And the novel is centered on a young psychiatrist and his wife, who is a patient, which I thought was kind of an interesting sort of twist and really mirrored the life of F. Scott and his wife, Zelda, at the time.
Hmm.
And I felt like that was kind of like a nod. And there's adultery in it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's
salacious.
It's a salacious sort of
But like
situation.
Everything you're saying, and I'm like, I need to read this like yesterday. How did I miss this?
Yeah.
I'll be curious in what 30s somewhere, right?
Yeah, early 1930s.
See, and that's very interesting because, like, did she actually have schizophrenia? Because do you know how many things qualified you for a schizophrenia diagnosis uh-huh. back then? So, boy, I'd be interested to read that
yeah.
when I'm done with yeah. my school.
Yes.
It will go on a list.
More than a few months.
Yeah, but, oh, thank God. More than a few months. But, I'm not done yet.
But less than a year. You'll be done. It'll be so exciting.
I used to be so excited. And then I get to read for fun again.
So Sherry had to make an apology video because she had a pandemic party. And the influencer was undoubtedly influenced by celebrities.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, yeah. Vanity Fair had an article, for every stage of the pandemic, there has been a celebrity getting into trouble for partying. So they did it talks about how a lot of A-listers did a good job at first, you know, promoting staying home and, you know, wearing a mask and going out as little as possible. And, you know, then as the summer of 2020 started winding down, they're like, what is the point of having all this money if I can't party maskless with all of my friends?
Yes. Yes. And they didn't do it smart. They didn't create bubbles.
No.
They didn't, like, do the things, you know, right. which is what's so annoying about it. But,
right. Exactly.
But that just speaks to the difficulty of extremes.
Uh-huh.
Extremes cannot be maintained for very long. You have to learn how to live
yes.
in it and
yes.
with it.
And through it.
Through it mm-hmm. and be smart and, you know. And if you force people into extremes without reason, then you're going to end up with rebellion.
Yeah.
That's or no without good
an end, if you can give people sort of an, which of course, how could you give people an end
you
to
can't.
A pandemic that you can't predict?
All of this is about what we talked about a long time ago, was the difficulty of people to change their mind.
Right.
Because if people are more open to going, oh, things have changed now, then it's so much easier to guide people without having to do extremes. But, you know, it's like the phrase, this is why we can't have nice things. You got people who refuse to change their minds about things.
Uh-huh.
And so because of that, you have to keep it more extreme in order to account for their, you know, stubbornness. Uh-huh. And then it's just, this is why we can't have nice things.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Justin Bieber and his wife had a party, but they, to their credit, there was a lot of people there, but it was mostly outside.
Okay.
So that's okay. Good. Kim Kardashian had a big 40th birthday event that cost $1 million.
And good God.
They all rented a plane and did all kinds of crazy things. And Diddy followed suit after that and was like, I'm going to move my birthday party to Turks and Caicos, and had to apologize for that. And Megan Thee Stallion had a Halloween party in Atlanta as cases were spiking. I mean, just so many. Rita Ora had to pay a big 10,000 pound fine because she had a birthday party that the police had to break up.
Jeez.
I mean, for real.
Oh, man.
So Cho mentions that there was a rumor that the Queen of England got a secret vaccine, and that the reason that Madre Linda was able to have parties was because a lot of the anti-vaxxer Madre Linda crowd had gotten a secret vaccine that was meant for the Queen. And no, there is no secret
That's
vaccine
ridiculous.
For the Queen.
Yeah, no.
I mean, just, you know. She did go on television. Oh, yeah, there you go. She did go on television and encourage people to get their vaccines. Mm-hmm. It didn't hurt at all. Just go and do it.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know how much sway she has, but she did it.
She is the queen
that.
And I appreciate
that. That's right.
That.
Exactly. So Sherry said that a friend who owned a vineyard 3D printed their own barrels.
Well, I mean, come on.
No, they didn't.
No, that's stupid. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That was dumb.
Yeah. So 3D.
This is why you should be very careful about mom influencers.
Yeah, exactly. Momfluencers.
Mom, I can't
Maybe
say
don't.
It. I can't even say it. Momfluencers.
Is it just a little too cutesy?
Maybe, but I actually think I just can't do it. Momfluencers.
Oh, you did it. Good.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but you can't 3D print with real wood. You can use a hybrid of plastic and wood grains.
I mean, you can 3D print a lot of stuff, but why would you do that to wine barrels?
I don't know.
That's not, it doesn't work. It doesn't help it at all.
It's not faster. It's not easier. It's not more cost efficient.
It won't taste better.
It will not taste better. It will taste worse. Can you imagine you're opening a bottle of wine and having, instead of an oaky aftertaste, it's a plasticky aftertaste?
Yeah, I mean, that's like the difference between having like a very natural kind of feeling, which is what's so delightful about wine, uh-huh. and like drinking something that smells like your Amazon Prime delivery.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Mm, I can just imagine them, this has recycle number 3.
Right.
Notes of recycle number 7.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
Yeah, ridiculous is right. All of the sources that we use to inform our discussion here on Killer Fun Podcast can be found on our social media. Join us on Facebook at Killer Fun Podcast, exploring the intersection of crime and entertainment. You can find us on Twitter at Killer Fun Pod, or you can send us an email at killerfunpodcast@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to share a link to whatever information you're looking for. We love to hear from you. You might learn a little something too. So, psychology break.
Okay.
Marital conflict can be hard on children, and Joe is right to be concerned.
He is right to be concerned. This mm-hmm. is a sticky topic right here. You're going to open this door.
Just a little bit.
Okay.
So heysigmund.com says it's widely accepted that parental conflict does damage, particularly when it's frequent, heated, physically aggressive, unresolved, about the child, or brings on silent treatment between the parents. So it can harm the parent-child bond, trigger psychological and behavioral problems, contributes to poor academic performance and poor interpersonal skills, emotional insecurity. You should really learn to disagree well if you're having a hard time in your marriage, and that will be helpful not only for your marriage, but for the well-being of your children.
Yes. By all means, please go to Gottman.com.
Yeah.
John Gottman is, here's the thing about John Gottman though. All right. So I'm going to say.
Okay.
His stuff is so, so good. Okay. All right. Are you familiar with Gottman?
Yeah.
Okay. No. You know of Gottman. So his stuff is so good, but it's not built for crisis.
Okay.
It's not built for crisis repairing.
Okay.
But it does help for normal level range disagreements that could become crisis.
Okay.
So definitely go to Gottman because you know what? Maintenance is key. Like you got to go for the maintenance. You got to do all of those kind of things. But if you're in crisis, this is where counseling is super, super helpful.
Uh-huh.
But maybe a Gottman counselor, maybe not.
Okay.
Because if they're really Gottman counselors, they may not be trained to deal with actual crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So FYI.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Joe thought he should stay with Love for Henry's sake.
You went there? Oh, you opened the door a little wider.
Yep.
I was wondering if you were going to go here.
There's no across the board right or wrong answer.
Nope. There's not.
Nope. And fatherly.com, parenting in ruins. Should you stay together for the kids? Basically, he says, yeah, there's no right answer. Patrick Coleman wrote this article in April of 2021, which I'm guessing is probably a response to the pandemic because there were a lot of struggling marriages prior to that. And, not less struggling after, being at home all together for 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
You're either better or not better.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. He says the tough thing about making the decision to divorce after you've had children is that it requires much more thought and self-reflection than the decision to get married probably ever did.
Which is sad, because done that beforehand.
Right, yeah, maybe you could have avoided the whole situation.
The research is so mixed on this.
I mean, it really is. He says there's plenty of research that says divorce can be harmful to children, but there's also evidence that commitment to co-parenting can offset future problems to the kids. He said that it can be destabilizing, particularly at first, because children do thrive in a situation where they know what to expect.
Yes.
Where they can just know that their everyday needs are being taken care of, mm-hmm. and they can just get on with the business of growing up rather than worrying about what's happening with their parents' relationship. But it's really only helpful if you and your partner are capable of maintaining a united front. Because you see, the stability in relationships is just as important as the structural stability of keeping put. You might be saving your child from the dizzying confusion of joint custody, but the trade-off is watching you and your partner slowly tear each other to pieces. Children are looking to us to learn what a healthy relationship looks like.
Yes.
So that doesn't mean you can't ever argue in front of your kids. It just means you need to argue effectively.
Right.
You need to argue in a way that's not demeaning to one another. You can disagree and model good behavior around disagreement.
Yeah. And you can model reparative actions.
Yes.
You can model,
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Or
I made a mistake and mm-hmm. let me acknowledge that.
Right.
Yeah.
Seeing you make a plan to take time to go talk about something or whatever, but it is hard because this is why divorce is such a trauma.
Uh-huh.
To parents who are going through it and to the kids, and because there is no good consensus. And I wish there was a flow chart. I wish somebody could take all the research and say, oh, if this, then that, and you could follow a flow chart and it should say, oh, well, my chances are good or my chances are bad. It just doesn't work that way.
No.
But you can note that a few things are fairly consistent throughout research. And that doesn't mean they're going to happen because, there's a big difference between research defining a trend and likelihoods and giving you odds. Statistics and research does not give you expectations.
Right.
Right. So when I say this, it's not an expectation. It's just a likelihood.
Yeah.
So usually joint custody can be very difficult on a child, and they tend to do worse in school. They tend to struggle more in relationships and attachments. Mm-hmm. That's a tendency, not an expectation.
Right.
It doesn't mean your child is going to experience that. It means that if I'm looking at a child of a divorced couple and a child of a not divorced couple, I can probably place my bet.
Yeah.
On who has better grades.
Right.
And that's a different scenario. But what it does do is it informs you not to not do it. It informs you on what you need to prepare for.
Mm-hmm. And they actually have a suggestion.
Great.
For that is some families find that if you have a central home mm-hmm. where the children reside all the time and the parents filter in and out.
Mm-hmm.
I actually know somebody who does this. That they had a family home. Mm-hmm. I think they've changed it now. They've been divorced several years, but they decided they wanted their kids to stay in their home,
mm-hmm.
especially while they went through this traumatic time. So right. they had a family home and mom had a room and dad had a room, but they didn't stay there at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So mom had a room, and when it was dad's turn, mom would go be at other places.
Yeah, this is an up-and-coming trend as a protective factor against uh-huh. what the trends are telling us.
Right.
Because it's not necessarily meaning that it's wrong to get divorced in your case, but it does mean that these are some minefields you need to be aware of
mm-hmm.
and maybe do some work to,
right.
to prepare for that, because maybe staying together is worse
right.
than that. I don't know, but it's just sticky because mm-hmm. the guilt on parents that this is happening is really, really difficult.
Right.
And then unfortunately, because of that guilt, we end up causing even more harm. So
right.
You got to talk about it. You got to be open about it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tough.
But Joe in the show, right?
Show.
Like, it's interesting that he feels such a need.
Uh-huh. Well, and that ties right into Joe's struggles with the effects of his mother's abandonment.
Right, which is in his case extreme.
Well, yes.
Extreme abandonment, mm-hmm. extreme trauma, right? But it's interesting to see how he wants to create that family and how that does, at least in his narrative, say that he wants to want to change.
Right.
Maybe that he doesn't want to necessarily, but he wants to want to because he sees that why can't I just be happy with this?
Right, right.
Right?
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, he's like, how could I?
Right, yes.
I'm like, well, she's a murderer. You're a murderer.
Yeah,
I feel like it's all out in the open.
You
like,
have something in common.
I mean, you've talked about all your crazy secrets.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm like, actually, you're in a pretty good spot, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But
I would think, well, our everyday life has an article about that, that it basically says that a mother can physically abandon a child, which is what happened to Joe, mm-hmm. or even emotionally abandon yeah. a child where they just kind of seclude into themselves.
Right.
Which sometimes that happens because moms are humans.
Yes.
You know, and sometimes we shut down for whatever reason. It tends to make children feel like they're unlovable, or that they did something so bad, which in Joe's case, he feels like he did something so bad that he made his mother leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's so hard because this is why parenting is such a long haul.
Yeah.
Because you really have to stay in the game through their transition to adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being, there's a lot of ways our children feel abandoned, like all the time.
Right.
But they won't once they're adults. And they make that transition and they realize,
right.
oh, you were being a parent because I was a child.
Uh-huh.
And then that's all reconciled and you go on and enjoy adulthood.
Right.
But for a lot of kids who experience abandonment and felt abandonment, but they weren't. They felt common rejection and abandonment for not
right.
getting what they wanted.
Right.
Or for feeling like it's not fair that my mom had to work and my friend's mom got to stay home. Things that are like normal, but no, it's not abandonment.
Right.
And it's not abandonment because she didn't just bow to your tantrums.
Right.
And it's these things that are validly feelings that they're feeling, but we have to help them walk through that so that as adults, they can handle it when a friend ghosts them.
Right.
Real abandonment.
Yeah.
And find the tools, you know, but if you don't make it past that where they can reconcile with the parents, like there's that failure to launch, that failure to look back and say, oh, like, I think there's kind of two versions of that. Like there's the whole like boomerang, whatever, that's financial and that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah.
But like the idea that some people never grow out of that.
Right.
They blame their parents for things that are actually quite normal because they just never went through the process of reconciling it.
Uh-huh.
you know, forgiving their parents.
For sure.
Or just understanding that, oh, they were the kid and they were a kid. And so nobody would forgive. Everybody just did their job.
Like, right. Yeah. Everybody's just living their life.
Right. Everybody's fine.
Yeah. You're the center of your life. You need to also be the center of your parents' life.
Right. No.
Yeah. 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 The CPSD Foundation had the long-term effects of abandonment. Adults tend to have some issues, some of which apply to Joe and some of which don't. So they fear giving too much in a relationship. That's not Joe. He doesn't ever fear that. Push people away to avoid rejection. No, Joe doesn't push anybody away. He draws them in closer.
Yeah.
There are people pleasers. Maybe Joe. Maybe. A little bit. They tend to experience codependency.
Check.
Joe.
Ding.
Feels insecure in intimate relationships. Sometimes Joe. Oh, yeah. Require repeated reassurances that they are loved. Absolutely, Joe.
Absolutely, Joe.
Uh-huh. Need to control others. So very Joe. Jump from one relationship to another. Very Joe. And will sabotage their relationships. Yes.
Ding.
Mm-hmm. Mood swings and anger issues can be traced back to abandonment in infancy. So he wasn't abandoned as an infant, but he definitely has some mood swings and anger issues.
Well, he was kind of abandoned emotionally.
Well, that's true. He didn't get physically abandoned until later, but his mom was not present, despite the fact of a physical being there.
Right.
So it was layers of abandonment for poor Joe. I can feel sorry for him and still understand that he's wicked.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. There are 5 stages of love, according to BetterHelp. And Joe really has a hard time getting past the first one.
Yeah, pretty much.
First one is the passionate beginning. And Joe can't seem to get past that part without murdering somebody.
I know. I mean, if he could just, I mean, not that I'm advocating for being like promiscuous, but like you could just be a player.
Yeah.
You don't have to murder people.
Right.
You could just be like, all right, I'm done with you. Next freak of the week. Uh-huh, yeah. To use a college term from way back. Yeah, but no, this is why he's not just a player. He's that's why. Murderous.
Yeah, exactly. Stage 2 is things start to get serious. Mm-hmm. So
he does get there.
He gets there. In the relationship, but he doesn't get there in the love, really.
Right. Because it's all like meshed with the first stage.
Right.
Are you the one?
Right. Yeah. And then he's trying to figure out, can she still be the one in the midst of the second one?
Yeah. And like test. Uh-huh. Test.
Stage 3, disillusionment, where a lot of couples don't ever get past that.
That's true.
You know, you find that you're no longer like this person. You either have to push through it or you settle for mediocrity or you end the relationship. These are the things that you can do. Real love is stage 4. If you can push past that disillusionment and get to stage 4, then you just kind of accept the other person's eccentricities and love them for it or despite of it. In stage 5 is the most mature, where you start making a difference together, where you might go and volunteer and do things for the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Real life. So happily ever after, where does that phrase come from? It was first used in relation to marriage in Giovanni Bisacci's translation of Il Decameron in 1702.
Okay.
Yeah. But when it was first used, it was happy ever after, and it referred to heaven. So a little different than death, unless you're Joe. He might consider that.
That's
death.
Very, very true.
Uh-huh. That's right. Joe wanted a daughter, but got a son.
Yeah, that was a very interesting thing that he went through.
Okay, so this might be one of the most honest things about Joe, honestly, because fatherly.com had an article, American parents say they prefer sons, but they act like they prefer daughters. There has been a Gallup poll since the early 1940s asking families what they prefer. Okay. Do they prefer a son or a daughter? And they slightly prefer sons,
they
say. But when it comes down to it, when you start looking at the statistics A strong preference for male children would imply that if a daughter is born first, we'd see an increase in fertility rates of families continuing to try until they
got a son.
Until they got a son. And that's actually not the case. That a firstborn daughter predicted a steep decline in fertility, and this decline increased after more female children.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. So we say we want boys.
Of course, the money also decreases much faster with females. Uh-huh. So maybe it was like an economic decision. Yeah,
it's possible.
Like, oh, we wanted a boy, but now we can't afford one.
That's fair.
I thought that was an interesting thing he went through.
Uh-huh.
That fear that a son would turn out like him.
Yeah.
Well, that was a very interesting thing.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, it was the thing he struggled with the whole time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When really it doesn't matter, son or daughter.
Because, right.
It's how you raise the child.
Yeah, and if he had a daughter, she's going to turn out like the mom. And, well, uh-huh. I mean, six one way, half a dozen the other. Yeah, so.
Exactly.
But it was an interesting thing that he thought he might be able to raise them right if it was a girl. But if it was a boy, he wasn't sure how he'd be able to. Because he knows.
Because he always related to the girls.
Yeah.
He understood girls. He understood how to manipulate girls. Mm-hmm. He was bullied as a child. He never had this control or understanding of the other males in his life. Mm-hmm. He wanted a girl because he thought he understood them.
Yeah. It's a very interesting thing. Mm-hmm. I love it.
For sure, for sure. So Dottie probably thought she was being super clever with her unique grandmother nickname of Glamma. Parade.com from October of this year, so just a few weeks ago, suggested Glamma as one of the 50 grandmother alternative names.
Oh my gosh.
And so I would say if Parade.com is suggesting it, it's not all that, like, creative or unique.
No.
Yeah.
I think Blanche was the original Glamma, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go. That's C, and that's fine. There's a ton of silly names. Meemaw, Nanny, those are pretty normal.
That's normal. That was mine. That was a normal one.
Yeah, Nanny is what my kids call my mom.
I also had a Mommine.
Oh, okay.
I don't know where it came from.
Abuela. All variety of other names.
My dad's grandpa name is Big Papa.
Oh. Aww.
It's adorable. Aww. And then he has no idea why I go up to him and going, I love it when you call me Big Papa. And he looks at me like, what?
What? That's so funny. Oh, some of the worst ones they suggested. Foxy. Sassy.
I just saw Dana Carvey in full force in front of me. I'm sorry. Woo!
That's funny. All right. Sassy. Birdie.
Mm-hmm.
No.
No, no. A birdie around here makes a little more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Bird Johnson. Maybe it's a little bit more, but I don't know. Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
So Joe stole some of Natalie's panties, as he does.
This scene. Oh, infuriating. Okay.
So in September of this year, 2021, there was a Japanese man who had stolen 730 sets of undergarments from laundromats. And they caught him. And they said, we haven't confiscated such a large number of panties in years.
I'm sorry. Say that sentence again.
We haven't confiscated such a large number of panties in years. Yeah, because the last guy they arrested had 1,100 pairs of underwear.
Oh, my God.
And that was in 2019.
Why is that a thing, people? Ugh. Oh, I'm... Okay.
But not to be outdone,
oh, no.
In July, there was a man in Pasadena who wasn't just stealing them from laundromats. He was breaking into women's homes, broke into three different women's homes to steal their underwear out of their drawers and out of their laundry.
Oh, no, no, sir. No, sir. You are, that That is case in point for being delusional.
They want the ones from the laundry more than they want the clean ones from your drawer. So researchers have known for a long time that underwear theft is linked to more nefarious activities.
You think? I love it when we have to do research to prove things like this.
The Seattle Times has an article in their archives from 1995, stolen underwear, an occurrence that points to serious problems. Mm-hmm. And Jennifer Bahoris, who wrote this article, talks about her home being broken into and that talking to police when they say there is a burglary, women will report a burglary, but they don't really notice anything missing. And even in 1995, the police were telling them, check your underwear drawer.
Oh my God.
I mean, really. And that a study found that a quarter of men who engage in stealing underwear and nuisance behaviors like that have raped women, and that half have molested girls.
Oh no,
so
ma'am.
This is a, yeah,
that's a problem.
It's stealing the underwear isn't just stealing the underwear and this oh cute weird thing that they do. It's like a big red flag. They need some counseling. He needs some help.
And then Joe takes it to that like next level.
Oh,
which
where
is
he's
just
checking
awful.
All. He's taking, oh, he took the bloody scarf.
But then he like holds the underwear.
Yeah. Oh, well, yes, that's later.
Yeah, we've watched past the first episode, obviously.
Yeah, obviously, yes.
And like that's a verse on this show. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, come on.
And finally, Love is far from the first female axe murderer. Yeah. There are lots. Frankie Stewart Silver was the first woman executed by the state of North Carolina for the murder of her husband with an axe in 1833. Mm-hmm. The Fall River axe murders, which is Lizzie Borden.
Yes.
But though she was acquitted, mm-hmm. nobody knows for sure what happened there. Ava Duncan was the first woman and last person executed by hanging in the state of Arizona because she murdered chicken rancher Andrew Mathis in 1927. Raimonde Ujano murdered her husband and three children in France with an axe in 1971, then jumped into a well.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, there's a fair few.
There's a
lot of axe murderers. Most of them are men. Some of them are women.
Yep.
So next time, I think we're going to talk about Lupin on Netflix.
Yeah.
So I had avoided this one for a long time because I thought it was, maybe I've watched too much Harry Potter, but I thought it was about werewolves.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's not.
Okay.
No.
Well, let's do it. I'm excited. I know nothing about this, so I'm going in very cold.
A man is avenging his father by injustices inflicted by a wealthy family.
Awesome.
Literally all I know.
Let's do it.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. We know you make a choice when you listen to us. Until next time, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.